Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tell someone you live in Columbus. Chances are what they are most familiar with isn't merely Ohio State University, but the Buckeyes, and not Buckeye women's gymnastics. We're talking football and basketball, the revenue sports, the sports that generated the revenue that put OSU second only to the University of Texas at Austin in the amount of money spent on athletics in 2009. Although university mission statements don't mention college athletics, football and basketball have assumed a major but significantly separate role at many institutions. Why? Simply why? Joining us now to ponder that question is Charles Klotfelter. He is the Z. Smith Reynolds Professor of Public Policy Studies and Professor of Economics and Law at Duke University, where he has taught since 1979. He is also director of the Center for the Study of Philanthropy and Volunteerism at Duke. Charles Klotfelter's new book, Big Time Sports in American Universities, examines the economic role of sports programs, and he's with us now. Welcome to the show, Charles.
It's great to be with you.
First of all, let's talk about what you mean by big time sports.
I defined big time sports as football and basketball at the highest competitive level, which means the football bowl subdivision and then Division One in basketball. So Ohio State is certainly a member of both of those groups.
And what is it about them that lifts them to the level of big time, per se?
If the Ohio State Athletic Department, just like the Duke University Athletic Department, were not part of a university, the statisticians in the Labor Department in Washington would classify these entities as firms in the entertainment business. So they are very, very commercial. They look and feel and walk like professional teams, but they happen to be inside universities. And it's interesting to note that the United States is the only country in the world where universities contain such commercial sports enterprises.
What's your sense about why it developed the way it did in the United States and not in other countries, say Western Europe, to be as comparable as possible?
There are theories about it, and it's very interesting to pursue. One of the ideas that I think is most appealing is that, in contrast to European universities, which were state-funded, universities in this country were supported by individual states and by philanthropy. And so colleges and universities were looking out for ways to bolster their financial position. And football, around the turn of the century, seemed like a logical idea.
You talk about bolstering the financial position, but these big revenue sports, while they may help fund other sports in the athletic department of the university, don't benefit the academic side per se, do they?
Well, it's not clear. I could talk a little bit about that, but I'd just tell you the bottom line on my analysis of this. One of the things I really hoped to do in the book was to say, hey, is this a good idea or a bad idea? Because we're pretty much stuck with this, and I don't think big-time sports is going away. So the question was, are the costs or the benefits greater? And I looked at universities with and without big-time programs over the last 15 years, and really there's not a lot of movement. It appears to be in the U.S. that you can have a great university with big-time sports or a great university without big-time sports.
So the idea of having big-time sports at university, well, let's talk first about another idea that you bring up in the book that I hadn't thought about before you suggested it to me in your book, that most, if not all, colleges and universities completely ignore sports in their mission statements. Ohio, of course, I looked up Ohio State, and it is an exception. 11 words are devoted to intercollegiate athletics in the fourth paragraph. I'll read it, the fourth paragraph. Well, all it says is our intercollegiate athletic programs will routinely rank among the elite few, period. That's pretty much all it says about intercollegiate athletic sports. Is that typical, or is that more than usual, or is that changing? Is that a changing dynamic or changing idea at this point for the big-time universities and collegiate sports?
No, the Ohio State University is very atypical. In my book, in my opinion, mm-hmm. Ohio State is on the honor roll because It is one of five universities out of 52 with big-time sports programs whose mission statement refers to athletics at all. And in the case of Ohio State, as you just read, they're very explicit about it. And so I think that a lot more universities should emulate the kind of candor that Ohio State is doing to say it is a big part of what we do in the university. Why don't we just come clean and say that?
My guest is Charles Klotfelter. He is teaches economics and law at Duke University, where he's also director of the Center for the Study of Philanthropy and Volunteerism at Duke. Charles' new book, Big Time Sports in American Universities, is what we're talking about this hour. If you have a question or comment for him, please give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Getting back to that candor issue, what is the value of the candor? What difference does it make?
Universities have set themselves up as institutions that stand for certain principles. And in fact, sometimes we're a little bit self-righteous about how good we are. And if we're going to hold truth-seeking to be one of our major aims, it would seem to be incumbent on us also to be candid about what we are. And I think there has developed, perhaps this is a way that universities market themselves, but there has developed a reluctance to admit that we are in the entertainment business. That doesn't say that we're not in the research and teaching business, but we are also in the entertainment business. So part of what I'm doing in this book, besides gathering all the information I can, is to say, come on, it would be consistent with our aims in other respects to be candid.
What inspired you then? Because you've been in academia for a good number of years and grew up in the United States, I imagine. What inspired you to write this book in the first place at this point in your career?
Well, Anne, your note that I grew up in the United States is quite significant, because my view of it is that somebody who did grow up here took it for granted that teams like Georgia Tech and Ohio State and Cal would have followings that would run into the hundreds of thousands, that people would be happy when the teams win and sad when they lose. We just took that for granted. But if you took somebody from Europe, or maybe even you just grabbed your local Martian, brought him to the university, and the Martian says, well, what does your institution do? And we would say research, a teaching, and service. And then you show them around, and lo and behold, you get to the football stadium, and the Martian turns to you and says, what's this doing here? And that really is the question that I tried to address in the book, is what is it doing here?
Now, a lot of people, the idea of college sports, when you think about it, it isn't necessarily for the students anymore, not the big time college sports. Income has a lot to do with whether you can avail yourself of a football game on a Saturday.
Yes, indeed. It turns out that college football fans tend to be a little bit more affluent than the average. And if you want to get a 50-yard seat at an Ohio State game, this is not the same as a Duke football game, but if you wanted to get a good seat at a strong program stadium, it will cost not only what the face value of that ticket is, but usually it will also require a contribution to the athletic department.
Unless you know somebody.
I guess that's right.
614-292-8513. And McLean in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you guys doing today?
Fine, thank you.
Very good. I was just listening to this interesting conversation here, and it invoked a book that I read actually for a sociology of education class 2 quarters ago. I'm sure the person there with you is familiar. It's by Murray Sperber. It was Beer and Circus. And in the book, Murray Sperber talks a lot about this same topic. And specifically, there's a couple chapters on just the issue of how the classroom environment is constructed, in contrast to how much money and how much time is spent on college sports. And I just wanted to ask your fellow there if he believes what, you know, or if he would agree with Murray Sperber in saying that these programs end up costing the universities money, especially in big-time sports, as opposed to, you know, the common perception that I think a lot of people have that the programs bring in, you know, large sums of money to the university.
Charles Klopfelter?
Well, I admire Murray Sperber's books. They are very colorfully written, and I think some of the themes in his books are reflected in mine. I don't really have opinions so much as data. But the question that the listener raises is a good one. Many people would assume that having a big-time sports program means money for the university, that is, a profit. But very few institutions have athletic departments that run a profit. I think Ohio State might be one of those. But it is the run-of-the-mill big-time sports program actually loses money if you burden that program with paying for the tennis team and the rowing team and the wrestling team.
Okay. So you think it's maybe the smaller-time sports that don't have the opportunity to bring in the revenue that more times than not end up costing the university's money?
Usually. But you might ask yourself the question, well, why should you leave it up to football to pay for the tennis team? And so that is a decision that most universities make, and that's the reason why both critics and the NCAA will emphasize that most programs lose money.
Okay, and I just kind of have one more supplemental question, and I'll go ahead and listen off air for your answer on this one. But just generally, do you think that it is the purpose of you know, universities to serve as these types of entertainment industries? Because as far as I've understood, the function of educational institutions in society is to spread information, to help people gain understanding, and to enact progress within the world. And I think that, I think that currently we're inside this kind of stalemate between our policy as far as governance and social kind of perception of things and being able to move forward with some of the problems that we face as humanity. Whereas we have these, you know, different types of distractions, I think that sports may or may not be included in that. And then I don't want to speak out against sports. I'm a sports fan myself. But I think that the university maybe should be focusing on what its original purpose is. So if you speak on that for a minute, I'll listen off air. Thank you very much.
Thank you, McLean.
Well, that is an excellent question, and let me try to do justice to the question. The listener sounds like a sports fan who loves sports but is a little nervous about what the implications are. And I'm that kind of sports fan, and I think that was the kind of sports fan that I wrote the book for, though I also wrote the book for serious tweed coat-wearing professors as well, because it is a book written for my fellow faculty members. Higher education is one of this country's greatest industries. In fact, it is one of the major exporters that the United States has. If you look at the list of the top 20 universities in the world by one recent ranking, 17 of those are American universities. So we have a great resource here. Bright people from all over the world come to our universities to study because we have figured out a way to do what we do, and we do it well. The challenge about having an entertainment industry connected to the higher education industry is that it could distort our priorities and could take away resources. That was one of the questions I looked at. Surprisingly, the entertainment aspect of these universities also has benefits for the academic program. Are they greater than the costs? I don't think my book can really answer that, but it would suggest two things. Number one is that the cost must not be so serious as to drag any university that engages in it down, because you look at these five universities who are ranked in the top 20 in the world, they have big-time sports. And the other thing is, I don't believe that the institutional, educational benefits of sports can justify it. What really needs to be used in explaining why we have it is because the trustees or boards of regents of Georgia want to be able to have a competitive team so that they can beat Georgia Tech every once in a while. And that the trustees at Stanford don't want to lose to Cal every year. And so ultimately it depends on the trustees saying, we want to be competitive.
We have to take a break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation about big-time sports in American universities, a new book by Charles Klotfelter. He's with us today. If you have a question or comment for Charles, and if you want to share what you think the role of collegiate sports is in the collegiate environment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and for as little as $60 per year, you can support our station and get some great benefits, too. As a member at our basic level, you'll receive a member card good for discounts at more than 200 area restaurants and attractions. You'll also receive a complimentary one-year subscription to Newsweek magazine, plus electronic versions of our airfare program guide and our e-newsletter. Visit WOSU.org and click Donate Now.
Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State's Comprehensive Cancer Center and James Cancer Hospital, rated exceptional by the National Cancer Institute. More information at cancer.osu.edu.
30 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today and a high near 48. Still cloudy tonight and a low of 29 degrees, and cloudy tomorrow with a high right around 45. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about big-time sports in American universities. That's the title of a new book by Charles T. Klotfelter. Charles is with us today. If you have a question or comments, please give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can join Frontline for an inside look at the multi-billion-dollar business of amateur college sports, including a class action lawsuit that aims to get players a piece of the action. Watch Frontline Money and March Madness tonight at 10 p.m. on WOSU TV. Christine from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was just wondering if your guest looked at the potential for increased value of degrees because of the notoriety that sports bring to the school. I know as an Ohio State alumni that doesn't really follow sports, that's one of the perks that I get from having graduated from Ohio State. I may not really care whether the team wins or loses, but if they do well, my degree's worth more.
Charles?
I don't know of any research that's been done on this, but it's a reasonable supposition that this could be the case. It certainly, one's degree becomes more valuable if one's institution gets better. This happens to many people. They go to a university, and then the university improves, and their degree is more valuable. Then the question is whether whether sports adds to the reputation of academic value.
Thank you, Christine.
Okay, thanks.
Take care. Speaking of research, another interesting idea you brought up, it might have been in your foreword, was the idea of how little research there's been done about this topic in any
right.
kind of scientific way.
It this did draw me to the subject a little bit. Just to say a word about how I got interested in the topic, mm-hmm. I had been a sports fan. I even wrote for my high school newspaper and was sports editor, so I'd always followed sports at the college level. And then after I got my degree in economics, I got my first job at a great university, a land-grant university that had a good economics department and great professors. And I noticed as I started going to lunch with these people, we would talk about the latest research in economics, but we'd also be talking about the basketball team. And I realized that this was a big deal to the people who worked there. And then I came to my present university, Duke University, and saw much the same thing. Really high-level researchers, great teaching, but a serious interest in the fortunes of our, especially our basketball team. I love football here, but basketball has been more famous. So what struck me was the disconnect between what the universities would say in their mission statement, most of them, what scholars would say about sports when they're writing books, and that is often absolutely nothing. Murray Sperber is really the exception. And compare that silence to the reality in which the teams and their fortunes would captivate not only the community, but the campus and, in fact, the entire state.
You write about the competitive nature in some places between the university presidents and the university coaches, the football coaches in particular. I just wanted to listen to something real quick. When a story broke about the 5-0 OSU football player suspended for selling team memorabilia, OSU President Gordon Gee was asked if he ever considered dismissing OSU football coach Jim Tressel, and here's his response.
No, are you kidding? Let me just be very clear. I'm just hopeful the coach just doesn't dismiss me.
Charles, you wrote in the he's a card, isn't he?
Gordon Gee has a way with words, doesn't he?
Yes. But, you wrote that in the 70s, OSU President Harold Enerson was said to resent the fact that his football coach, Woody Hayes, routinely garnered greater public acclaim. Is President Gee's response to that question a sign of the times, or is it like the part of the mission statement that we referred to earlier, an exception to the rule?
It could be a humorous acknowledgement of the reality of the situation. And we have to begin with the fact that there are very few university presidents more famous and better compensated than your Gordon Gee.
Mm-hmm.
And for him to say something like this acknowledges, and it's tongue-in-cheek to some extent, but acknowledges the reality that at most universities that have big-time sports, the football coach is not only better known, but much better paid than the president. And I thought the story about Einerson in the past and Woody Hayes was a little precious and humorous, but revealed a truth in that the president of a great university needs to get used to the fact that he or she may not be the most important person on campus. And for a university, for a potential university president to go in for interviews and to say something like, I think we need to knock down the stature of our big-time sports, I don't think that would be a second interview.
David from Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Ralph Nader wrote a letter to a publication, which I'm afraid I can't remember right now, but his basic proposal was to eliminate athletic scholarships at the college level, and that would not only clean up a lot of difficulties with college scholarship athletes, but it would also affect the high school level, because that's basically the training ground for the college. It's now thought of as pretty much necessary to excel at high school, too, before you even get to college. So thing really has gotten momentum. I understand it's probably impossible to put much brakes on it, but how about extending it over into the academic area so you have some kind of contest in academics? Big math board, everybody solve a problem, look, camera panning back and forth. I don't know. They did it with the chess match.
Well, you know, I remember in high school, my principal never went to those Model UNs that I participated in, but he was always at the football games. So what do you say, Charles?
It's a great idea. But then the second question you have to answer is how many people would come? And as soon as the crowd was estimated to be 23 for the math competition, then the local and network stations would say, you know, we're really not interested in covering this. I think we're going to go back and cover the football. So there is a kind of a reality check that is involved.
Thank you, David.
Sure.
614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call, our guest is Charles Klotfelder. He is the author of a new book. It's called Big Time Sports in American Universities. If you have a question or comment, you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. The intercollegiate sports didn't sprout intact from some 1950s, you know, gridiron cinematic fantasy, you know, starring Ronald Reagan or something like that. It really dates back to before the Civil War, which surprised me, again, among many surprises I had with the book. But when and why did football and basketball ending up getting all the glory versus, you know, soccer and other sports that have been around a long time, as lacrosse, for that matter?
I'm sure historians of sports could probably explain it, and I can't. James Michener, a great writer of the 60s and 70s, wrote a book on sports in America, and he ascribed our interest in football and basketball at the college level to a quirk in history. And I have read some of the histories that talked about how rugby and soccer came over to this country, and there was a kicking game, and then there was a running game, and basically, American football came about as a little bit of an amalgam, and it produced a formula that really began to captivate the interest of fans. And so back in at the turn of the century, a little bit before the turn of the century, there were really massive crowds at very exciting games played by teams from two universities. So the notion of big-time sports, as you say, didn't spring from Hollywood in the 1950s. It was around very early.
Richard in Mount Vernon, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm originally from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And the thing that struck me when I moved to Ohio about a year ago was that despite the fact that Ohio's got two major football teams, two major baseball teams, an NHL team, man, everybody is so into the Buckeyes. And I've lived other places in the country before, and I've never experienced a place where there was a rabbit about college athletics. Does your guest have any insight as to why Ohio is so unique in that?
Is this Richard? Is that right?
Richard, yes.
Richard, have you ever been to Louisiana or Alabama?
No, I have not.
Okay,
so
I think some people would say, as rabid as fans are in Ohio, it gets even crazier when you go into the Southeastern Conference. Believe it or not. So there, perhaps you should take a vacation around October and go into Birmingham and Tuscaloosa and see what happens down there. One of the historical curiosities about this, which I find really fascinating, is that big-time sports in this country, let's take football, grew up in areas that were not northeastern or big city, Midwestern. And
well,
those
in Texas, they're rabid about high school football.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So college football took root where there weren't professional teams and vice versa. Part of the reason that the pro teams were dominant in the Northeast and the upper Midwest was because of train travel and probably also because of segregation. So in the in the Southeast, there was a ban on integrated teams, and they were not open to professional teams. So as a consequence, if you look at, I've got a map in the book that shows where the greatest concentration of big-time football is, and it's in the Southeast and parts of the Midwest.
And a little pocket up in there in the Northwest, it looked like.
It does jump around a little bit, but most of it is where the pro teams weren't.
Thank you, Richard, for your call.
Thanks.
And
welcome
to Ohio.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. And Ed in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, two things, actually. One, there was an old movie with John Wayne where he played a football coach at a small college who got the program up into a very big program by actually recruiting almost semi-professionals who wouldn't go to class, and I thought that was an interesting movie. I can't remember the name of it, but it kind of speaks to a lot of what does seem to go on sometimes in the college classes. But the other thing was that back in, I think it was 1960, the Ohio State Faculty Senate voted not to let Ohio State go to the Rose Bowl, and there was such a backlash that that was never tried again, and I wondered if the author had studied that particular situation and whether he knows of any other school that has even tried something like that, because I have not heard of any.
You
and
do...
I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks, Ed. You do talk. You do write about faculty influence on the programs or lack thereof.
Yes, I had read about this of faculty vote about the Rose Bowl, but I didn't follow up on it. But it is very interesting and distinctive, because it's so unusual. One situation that I do write about in the book is at Berkeley. In the last 2 years, the Berkeley Senate has made the funding of big-time sports quite a big issue, because they found out in, first of all, the context is that California, like many states, is cutting public budgets, and they're cutting the budgets of the university. Their furloughs and instructors are being laid off. In that context, the Senate found out that the athletic department had run deficits for a number of years, and in fact, the accumulated deficit of a few years back had been completely forgiven, and they were not amused. And so they debated the question of whether to recommend some kind of cut in athletic spending. And, of course, recommend is all they could do, because they don't have the power to change anything, as vocal as they might be. So this issue is a big one, and occasionally faculty will debate it. One might say grandstand about it, but at the end of the day, the faculty don't have a great deal of control.
My guest is Charles Klotfelter. He is author of a new book. It's called Big Time Sports in American Universities. We're going to have to take a break, but first I want to remind you, you can join Frontline for an inside look at the multi-billion dollar business of amateur college sports, including a class action lawsuit that aims to get players a piece of the action. Watch Frontline Money and March Madness tonight at 10 p.m. on WOSU-TV. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
Jobs!
Altogether, some 3,500 unionized workers would be involved in constructing the casino. But disputes over annexation into the city and water and sewer service have led to litigation.
Get out of the courtroom, get into the boardroom, and get the shovels in the ground.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and WOSU Public Media presents the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Wednesday Forum. Wednesday at noon, it's Statistically Speaking, Females Fuel Leadership. Tickets and more information at columbusmetroclub.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting Southern Bound Comfort, featuring dancers Gregory McComa and Chanel Winlock in a pair of special duets with live music March 30th to April 2nd in the Wexner Center Performance Space. More at wexarts.org.
It's 30 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clouds today and a high near 48 degrees. Still cloudy tonight and a low of 29. Back up to 45 degrees for tomorrow with cloudy skies. And still some clouds tomorrow night with a low in the upper 20s. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Charles Klatfelter. He is the author of Big Time Sports and American Universities. We're going to get to those calls, but first we have a few emails. One from Bob in Columbus. It's a little lengthy, but it makes a point. Bob writes, I crewed on the OSU rowing team in the early 90s on top of paying for all our own equipment, staff and transportation, entry fees, uniforms, etc. Our team members also had to pay athletic participation fees to OSU, while football and basketball team members were given luxuries like chartered air travel. We pointed out to OSU athletic department that our team had over 90% class attendance and over 90% graduation rate, and a collective GPA above 3.2, and we therefore favorably represented OSU in our student body and therefore wanted funding for coaching, staff, and transportation. We were told we could have anything we wanted when we sold tickets like the football team sold tickets. Until then, we had to pay our own expenses plus some extra to use the university's name. Your guest is right. The university's name on athletic teams is merely coincidental with OSU as an academic institution engaged in shaping leaders and productive citizens. It's just about money, which, you know, kind of takes me back to that line, the one line in the 11 words in the mission statement. Our intercollegiate athletic programs will routinely rank among the elite few if you can afford to pay your way for most of them. Charles?
That could lead a lot of directions. I do feel for this former rower. One thing one might say about American universities is that they are not pure in the sense of being completely untouched by commercial forces. We can look at patents. There's money involved there. We can look at bringing on, say, fast food restaurants in our where the cafeterias used to be.
Well, what about Big Ten Network and those things?
Big Ten Network is a good one, too. But the thing about the athletics, which is different from even the hospitals, which are a big business, is that when in these other realms, when you talk about money, money is then traded off against academic values. So we might say it's okay to incentivize our professors with money because we're getting better research out of it. In the case of athletics, there truly isn't an academic value to be traded off. It's a part of the university that is 100% commercial. That is not to say that there's a great deal of educational value in participating and rowing and being in a field hockey club team. Those things do have educational value, but the commercial enterprise that is Big Time Athletics is pretty much a commercial enterprise. So there you have money for money's sake. Then the question is, what is it doing for the university? In the case of the Big Ten Network, which I think is being looked at with envy by other conferences, because in many ways it's being done to serve a lot of the educational values that athletics could have. For example, putting on television some of the minor sports. One other thing that I would give them a gold star for is saying we're not going to advertise alcohol. The NCAA has said and does, they advertise beer. They limit it, but they say we're going to justify this because of the money we're making. I think that that's a value trade-off that ought to be reexamined. And the Big Ten Network seems to be doing that well.
Richard from Columbus, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
This is Richard. Is it?
It's you, Richard.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yes. First of all, I want to thank you for a beautiful program you got here. This is wonderful.
Thank you, Richard.
Yes. And then your guest, he's right on target on a lot of things. But my main subject here is what he said earlier in the program about the universities and colleges in the United States are considered amateur. But when it gets down to money and funds and all that, they're considered semi-amateur, semi-pro. It's like having two bosses operating the same operation. One's pro, one's amateur. And it forces the teams, the coaches, the coaching staff, the leadership in the university to zig and zag back and forth. Well, who do we have to satisfy today? Well, we're not sure, and we're right on the line. Well, we'll take it this way and back and forth. So they're zigging and zagging to stay in the laws and the rules and regulations, and all of a sudden somebody higher up says, well, that was a very poor policy there, a poor decision. And all of a sudden they come down on, I call them innocent people and victims, like coaches and teams and leadership in these college universities, and it becomes a nightmare. You're not zigging and zagging correctly. Well, how would you know? See, I think you brought a beautiful situation, and it's what they have now is a short-term solution, but in the long run, I think it's going to bring a disaster, and it's going to make a lot of innocent people and well-intended people that were trying to do things right make them look like they're lower than low. And I think that's a tragedy.
Okay.
I thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Do you agree in the long run this isn't a good system, or in the long run it's the system we have, and but you recommend some possible changes or some places where things could be amended?
Charles? I do. A number of people encouraged me to talk about reforms, mm-hmm. and the major purpose of the book was to really say this is the way it is and to let other people decide whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. So I'm trying to just make facts speak for themselves. One of the facts that's relevant to Richard's question is the tremendous economic value that some of these amateur students have. In football, it's been estimated that having one more player on your football team who's going to be drafted by the NFL eventually is worth $500,000 a year for each player every year. And in basketball, the value of having a player who's going to be drafted by the NBA eventually is over $1 million.
The point being that you want to get them first because it brings value to the college, not that you're preparing them for the NHL or the NFL or the NBA.
That's a side function of colleges,
okay,
that to work as a minor league. But from the point of view of the university's athletic department, they are very valuable. And they're especially valuable because you don't have to pay them what the market would charge them. Now, I'm not saying that it would be easy to develop a policy to pay them, but right at the moment, the charge exploitation really does have some purchase.
Glenn from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. You've raised so many interesting questions. I might refer people back to the James Thurber from Ohio State book and movie, The Male Animal, which deals with some of these issues in a humorous way, and it's pretty transparently set at Ohio State. I had two things. One was that Gordon Gee, when he was, I think, at Vanderbilt,
yep,
he successfully eliminated the athletic department, so the football coach or there could not fire him. So I'm wondering how that
Well,
that
he merged
about.
It, didn't he, with their intramural. Is that right, Charles?
It is not clear what
okay.
really.
okay.
Vanderbilt announced that its athletic department would be subsumed into student affairs, but I think that the jury is out as to what that really meant. What I think it meant was probably, with all respect, not very much. That the board of trust, which is the trustee committee at Vanderbilt that runs things was still going to have the same feeling about the importance of athletics at Vanderbilt as they had the day before the change. And it's still the case that a president, well, at Vanderbilt it's called the chancellor. The chancellor at Vanderbilt is going to be on very thin ice if he or she decides to really rough up the football or basketball coach.
Thank you very much, Glenn. We have an email from Vicki. She writes, as a new Ohio State professor in 2004, my husband was on a private tour of the Thompson Library. He made a critical remark about overemphasis on the famous Buckeyes football team. The librarian quickly informed him that profits from the football program provide something like $500,000 worth of books for the library each year. My husband ate the crow and has repeated the story every time the subject of collegiate football comes up. So is that typical or not? And frankly, I'm not exactly sure what the pipeline of money from the Buckeyes football program is to Thompson Library, which is a fabulous institution, by the way.
I guess there are two points, and one has to do with the money. It looks to me as if Ohio State is one of those rare institutions where a profit does come out of the athletic department. So what was claimed could well be the case. But I think a larger and interesting point being told by the story is that universities, we claim to be bastions of free expression. And I joke sometimes about the fact that we could claim that communism is a good thing or, you know, marriage should be obliterated. And our fellow faculty members would simply blink an eye because, you know, that's what we do in universities. But criticize the football team at Ohio State, criticize the basketball team at Duke, and people will move away from you at the lunch counter. And so it is a level of really mass appreciation. And if I could just say one more thing, and this mm-hmm. is on the positive side. There are certainly ugly and costly things about big-time athletics, but I had to admit and really did it with joy that big-time sports does have some spillover benefits that are just inherent in the thing. And one of them is that people have joy and pride when their team does well, even if it loses, if it plays well. And that is not anything to be scoffed at. And the other thing that big-time sports, college sports, has given us, especially in the South, but I think for the entire nation, is examples of interracial teams that not only get along with each other, but can work together. And in my vision of it, I think that this is a very important civics lesson that we are taught every time we cheer for a team composed of people that don't look like each other.
We have an email from James, who asks, how about the University of Chicago? They were one of the original Big Ten members, the original monsters of the Midway before the Chicago Bears, won the Big Ten football championships numerous times. Soon after, the university president decided that intercollegiate sports had become too much of a distraction from academics, so he eliminated the programs. Could a similar move be taken today, or is there just too much money at stake? And, you know, it should be said that University of Chicago is an extremely prestigious place to attend school and for many programs.
Well, James's question brings up one of the great examples in the history of American big-time sports. Chicago is one of the very few universities that had big-time sports and decided to drop it. The only other important universities that had big-time sports and dropped it were Washington University in St. Louis and the Ivy League. And I think one of the really striking facts about the history of this whole enterprise is that once a university starts, they almost never drop it. Now, Chicago was the exception that proves the rule. Mm-hmm. In order for them to drop big-time sports, because they were really big, what it required was a president who hated big-time sports and railed against it, and and a series of losing seasons in which the last season they got demolished by everybody they played. And at some point, the trustees gave in and dropped it.
You know, one issue we've kind of skirted a little bit is the what some people view as the exploitation of the players. That seriously, college, even if they do graduate, and arguably more and more of them are these days, but even if they do get that degree, really it's a drop in the bucket, as you made the point earlier, particularly for those who are going to get drafted by the NFL or the NBA eventually anyways, that it's downright exploitative, and it should change. They should be paid.
Well, if they were paid, it would probably change the nature of the product in serious ways. So if that change were made, it should be done with the full sight that the mystique of college sports might decline. But on the other side, the word exploitation is one that we economists are not usually allowed to use. But if it's ever appropriate, it's probably appropriate here, because especially for the stars, they're worth $500,000 in football, over $1 million in basketball, yet they're paid just a pittance. And so especially when their likenesses are being used for profit after they graduate, it does seem a little hard to take.
And there is a lawsuit pending regarding that issue as well. Right.
Exactly.
Well, we could go on, and I'm sorry we couldn't get to all the calls or all the emails today. Obviously, it's a conversation we can continue having, and I want to thank Charles Klotfelter for joining us today.
Well, it was a pleasure to visit with you in Columbus.
Charles Klotfelter, he is the author of Big Time Sports in American Universities. He is the Z. Smith Reynolds Professor of Public Policy Studies and Professor of Economics and Law at Duke University, where he has taught since 1979. He's also director of the Center for the Study of Philanthropy and Volunteerism at Duke. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.